The teachings of self-realization are, by definition, universal. What we're talking about is being attuned with the divine spirit within yourself to realize that oneness, which is the heritage and the truth behind everything in creation. It's presumptuous and ignorant for any particular spiritual path or lineage of masters or religion to say we alone have the doorway. If we're walking into infinity, by definition, it's one reality, however diverse the entryways into that. So when Yogananda was alive, he called his churches the self-realization churches of all religions. And he did at the Lake Shrine, which was the facility in Southern California, one of the places that he set up, he put shrines, statues, to the various of the world's religions. But in fact, when he taught mostly from the New Testament and from the Bhagavad Gita. And when someone asked him, well, why don't you teach simultaneously from all the scriptures? His answer was somewhat enigmatic until you understand it on a deeper level. He said simply, it is the will of Babaji that we do it this way. Now, Babaji, for those of you who don't know, is it's a drawing, actually, but it's the person represented at the top of the cross here. Babaji is, according to the way Yogananda describes him in his book, Autobiography of a Yogi, is an ever-living master. Most saints and gurus, even if their consciousness is infinite, they'll take a body and live a more or less normal human span of life. Jesus lived 33 years. Yogananda was just over 60, I believe, when he died. Sri Yukteswar lived into his 80s. Lahiri Mahashaya lived into his 80s. They were born, they were children, they were young men. Then they grew old and died. There are exceptions. In Autobiography of a Yogi, Yogananda describes a great saint named Trilanga Swami, who was enormously fat and was said to have 1 pound on his body for every year of his life, and he was something like, had lived for like 300 years. There were grown men whose fathers had known Trilanga Swami when they were children. So the estimate was about 300 years that he kept his body. Then there is a figure like Babaji, whom Yogananda describes in Autobiography of a Yogi, whose birth is unknown, and who has made a promise that he will retain his physical form for this whole cycle of creation. Now, the masters play with time and space and life and death. We have many examples in Yogananda's life, in Lahiri Mahashaya's life, in Sri Yukteswar's, in the life of Jesus, how the master could resurrect the dead. The story of Lazarus in the New Testament is quite an extraordinary one. Lazarus is in the tomb for 3 days. Jesus comes and demands that the tomb be open. No one wants to open the tomb. They think that there'll just be a rotting corpse in there. Jesus insists. They roll the rock back, and then Jesus calls to Lazarus, and Lazarus walks out of the tomb, which in this case is a cave, and he's all in the winding sheets, the garment, the long strips of fabric that they wind him up in. He walks out the same way he was laid in, and then he sort of takes all these things off and continues to live. The masters just laugh at life and death, where it all seems so to have such a tremendous hold on our consciousness, it really has no hold on theirs. Because they understand, even as the physicists are telling us these days, that which we call matter really has no solid form, that it's just a pattern of energy. And once you understand how that pattern is created, then you can continually recreate it by the power of your thought and by the strength of your consciousness. This is what masters have, which is they have simply transcended the seeming limitations of this world. And what they do then, from our perspective, seems miraculous. But it's really quite scientific. Yogananda writes in Autobiography of a Yogi, a chapter called The Law of Miracles, which merely to read it is not the same as being able to do them, but at least he gives us an idea that this is an orderly universe, and if we can see it orderly at any stage, there's no point at which it becomes irrational. It's just a question of mastering the skills. I mean, to see some people sing or do mathematical problems or engineer something may seem to another person like a pure miracle. How did you know how to do that? But if you've learned the rules, if you've learned the laws, some people understand money that way. They just know how to make money work or make business work. It's because you've applied yourself, in fact, over many lifetimes, to developing those abilities and the magnetism that comes with it, and then you can just move this world in ways that look impossible to others but are perfectly natural to you. And so this is what the masters offer us. Now, even though we are walking into this infinite reality, at which point when we're all at the top of the mountain, it really doesn't matter how we got up there, we've all arrived at the same place. Still, in order to reach the top of the mountain, skill in any field, at a certain point we have to begin to focus in our consciousness. We need to be able to choose one path and to walk it with skill. Because even though all paths lead to the mountain, the top of the mountain, if you run around shifting from one to the other, as Yogananda used to put it, he said you could drive many cars from San Francisco to New York, but if you get halfway across California and decide that you need another model and go back to San Francisco and buy another one, trade that one in and then start across and get just across the border of California and decide that's not the right one and go back and turn it in and get another, he said, you'll never get to New York. He said you could walk faster than you could get there if you're always shifting and never clearly deciding where you're going to go and how you're going to get there. So one of the principles of self-realization, and what I was starting to say is we've always had a little bit of a dilemma, because even though we emphasize the universality of this particular path of self-realization, when you walk into this temple, you see a line of masters on the altar. And any attempt, you know, to take those pictures off so that we won't be so definite, we won't be so seemingly narrow, is also insincere in terms of really wanting to offer people a path to self-realization that will actually take you somewhere. So Yogananda, coming with the church of all religions, nevertheless put this line of gurus there and spoke only from the Gita and the Bible because his guru told him to do that. And rather than any other long explanation of what might be the reasoning, which in fact I can offer a few reasons why he only chose those two scriptures, essentially they represent symbolically and almost literally the essence of what's offered in the East and the essence of what's offered in the West, plus the clarity and the simplicity of both the teachings of Christ as Jesus intended them, not as they have been since tangled up by various institutions, and the same for Krishna, not as they have since been tangled up by hundreds and hundreds of years of imposed rituals and images and so on. But that they are the essence of the path of self-realization. And by unifying those two, from that you can infer the unity of everything else. But Yogananda didn't explain any of that. He said, this is what my guru wanted. Now, we tend to think of Yogananda himself as being the source, which is perfectly reasonable, because he is the master from whom in the West we draw this teaching. He's the one who came to live in California. He wrote Autobiography of a Yogi, which is the sort of founding textbook, you might say, of this whole path of self-realization, and really much more than most people realize, launched this whole interest in Eastern religion. Almost everyone who steps outside of traditional religious institutions in the West reads Autobiography of a Yogi. Whether they become a disciple of Yogananda, follow this path or not, in any group of people who are thinking in this light, almost all of them have read Autobiography of a Yogi. And if you're one of the few who hasn't, I encourage you to rectify that error as soon as you possibly can. When we used to travel to India on a regular basis, we used to take pilgrimage groups over there for over a period of about 20 years, every year or two, we would do that. And the guide would always say to us when we were on the bus on the way to Agra to see the Taj Mahal, which is really worth seeing, the guide would say, there's two kinds of people in the world, those who have seen the Taj Mahal and those who haven't. And you are about to enter the group who has, you know. And it was an appropriate way to put it, one of the seven wonders of the world, certainly. Well, there are those who've read autobiography and those who haven't. I encourage you to put yourself into that vibration. It is well worth doing. But in any case, coming back, let me think to where I was. Hold on, let me find it. Because of that, we tend not to remember as much that Yogananda himself, even though Autobiography of a Yogi is to the greatest extent really about other saints and masters. In fact, Swami Kriyananda has written a screenplay for a movie called Yogananda, which is really getting a lot of traction in Hollywood, actually, to be made into a feature film, because Swami Kriyananda lived with Yogananda and knows what he was like. Many times people have tried to make a movie, but they always try to make Autobiography of a Yogi, which is not about Yogananda. It's about all the saints and masters who influenced him, including Babaji, Sri Yukteswar, all the years of training that he had. And there's no real storyline about Yogananda in there. He's, in fact, an invisible force except for his consciousness to a large extent. It's not an autobiography in any real sense of the word. But what we find in Autobiography of a Yogi is we find the demonstration of how we become self-realized. Now, even though Yogananda himself was born with that infinite consciousness, that's what it is to be what we call an avatar, which is one who is fully realized before birth. Jesus, Krishna, Yogananda, Lord Rama, many others, Buddha, that's what made them world-changing powers, is that their consciousness was infinite before they were born. They didn't attain that through effort. But you see, interestingly, in all cases, all of their lives, with the exception of Jesus, because all the years of his sadhana, of his spiritual practice, are taken out of the Bible. That's what he was doing from the age of 13 to 30 before he shows up again. According to the Indian tradition, according to Yogananda, he left where he was, he went to the Himalayas, he trained with the masters, and then he came back. And that was in the Bible, but in an attempt to show that he was so all-powerful, he never had to learn from anyone, they took that out. And what they did in doing that is they left all of us totally confused as to how to get from where we are to where the master is. Because what the masters do is they act out for us how you walk, the path that you walk. What path do you walk from here to the top of the mountain? And they take a physical body and they willingly, as I've described it in other ways, they willingly enter the prison of incarnated life and then show us how to escape from that prison. But they're innocent when they enter it. They enclose themselves as we're enclosed. We're guilty of having karmic desires. They're innocent of any karmic desires, but they enter the same prison anyway and allow the doors to lock behind them. But they understand exactly how to work the system and get out of it, whereas we sort of bang around and keep filing the wrong briefs and having the wrong attorneys and getting really confused about what we're doing. They know exactly. Or another way of thinking of it is, you're in paradise, or you're in the state of spiritual freedom, and you get thrown over the wall. And you're thrown over the wall, and then there's this huge wall between you and that vision of infinite freedom. And unfortunately, all the lights and all the glittery things that look so attractive cause us to turn our backs to the exit point and walk away from it. So we're born and we start grabbing and reaching. Oh, look, I could marry this person, I could have that, I could do this. And it all just takes us farther and farther away. Where the masters land on the other side of the wall, they look at all this stuff, they see right through it that's not really going to make me happy, and they turn back around and start burrowing back through the wall. And that's what their spiritual spiritual sadhana, their spiritual practice is burrowing back through the wall. And that wall is what divides us from the fulfillment we're seeking, and all these toys over here are entertaining, and they're not hideous. They just don't turn out to be what we thought they were. until we gradually figure out that the problem is this wall between us and our divine source. And so the masters live. They find their gurus. They do their spiritual practices by great, tremendous example of dedication. They show us how to hone all of our abilities until we can tune right through, tune in and burrow through that density that keeps us from understanding. And one of the ways we burrow through that density is we ride in the wake. We attach ourselves to the tail, so to speak, to the vibratory tail of the master who's going that direction. And this whole concept, which is what's talked about in our reading today, called attunement, and this extraordinary statement of Jesus's, to all who received him, gave he the power to become the sons of God. That is such an extraordinary statement. Swamiji picked it out of the New Testament and put it into our Festival of Light. The very beginning, on the first page of that festival, as the Bible says to us, to all who received him. What on earth does that mean? Because that is certainly what we're looking for, isn't it? And another aspect of that is, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God. Because when you think about the difficulty, that word power is really key. Power is one of the eight manifestations of God. It's one of the ways that God comes into this world, because power is exactly what we need, isn't it? Because we have to have more power in our determination to transcend this world than this world has to continually draw us back into it. Isn't that the difficulty that all of us face? We're so clear in our intention, at least sometimes, if not every minute of every day. Every once in a while it occurs to us in a really big way that I would be a lot happier if I were God realized. And that no matter how kind of nifty all this other stuff is, my heart longs for more. And that's really what I want. That's really who I want to be. There's nothing that compares. Swami Kriyananda once, when he was talking about secrets of self-acceptance and loving yourself, he said there's no way to do it except to have a clear conscience. It was just as simple as that. As long as your conscience is clouded, you're going to feel uncomfortable about yourself. Duh! I mean, like, what we're all looking for is some way to completely transgress all the divine laws and then still feel wonderful. So we declare that we feel wonderful. We declare that it doesn't matter, and then we just go, and not to use the common phrase, sin again and again. But we're not made that way. There are divine laws. It isn't a question of man's morality. It isn't a question of society's laws. It's we are made a certain way. And when we live in harmony with that pure quality of divine awareness, then we have bliss accordingly. And when we violate that divine law, live in fear, live in self-aggrandizement, take advantage of others, are inconsiderate in all the small ways, try to do something that satisfies us on a lesser level, it's not a terrible thing to do. It's just a dumb thing to do. And it's dumb for a very simple reason. It doesn't give us what we want. That's all. Nobody has to punish us. It punishes us itself. If we're out of tune with our higher nature, we suffer in exact proportion to how much we are. But the struggle is that those temptations, those inclinations, those mental habits, those deeply held beliefs, those fears, you can call them anything you want, they just have a lot of power, don't they? That no matter how much we reason, we keep finding ourselves there again. I finally sort of got a picture in my mind of what it's like. It's like I'm sitting here and I have a very clear idea of where I want to go, and I set out to go there. But I don't actually realize that the channel through which my energy flows is bent so that I think I'm going straight and I've actually ended up here. It's like, you know, if you have a habitual posture, you think you're standing up straight. You don't know that you're not standing up straight. If you're habitually singing the wrong note, you think that's how the melody goes. You think you're singing it correctly, but you're not singing it correctly. And then there's a force to that habit. This is what incarnations, this is what karma is. Karma is the force of habit. The force of habit that says, oh, this is what I'll do and this will make me happy. And we're working on it, we're learning, and karma teaches us by showing us whether it does make us happy or not. And the great fun is we get to keep trying. Somebody asked Swami Kriyananda recently, you know, I have this desire to have a nice car and a nice home and, wear nice clothes, and what should I do about that? He said, well, Swami said, just try to get those things. He said, don't be ashamed of that. He said, there's no point in being ashamed of how you feel. If that's what you think you want, then do your best to try to have it. It's just such a simple answer. This isn't a matter of pretending that we're something that we're not. This is going through the force of karma that's in us with eyes open, with an honest mind, and just see whether it works or not. Because to just have somebody take it away from you, God doesn't want you to have this, this is wrong, you're supposed to be detached, you shouldn't feel that way, that really doesn't help anything. Much better to just say, well, Lord, this is the way you made me, and here I am, and we're going to work on this, and show me what's going to happen. Let's see what happens. But those forces, we reach a certain point where we have those desires, but we've also begun to understand that we have another desire, too. And that desire is to realize God. But that's where the battle begins. That's the battle of Kurukshetra, is that the power of those other thoughts keeps pulling us back again and again. Oh, yes, I really want to be like this, but oh, I'm makes me nervous. I really want to do that, but oh, it makes me a little afraid. I really am going to renounce this, but oh. So what we need is we need the power of God to come in. So that even though when those thoughts and temptations and inclinations come up, we can push them aside with a greater power, not in the sense of deprivation, but in the sense of triumph and victory. You know, when you set your mind to do something that you really want to do and you know is important to do and takes discipline to do it, and day after day you have to say, no, I can't go out to the movies with you because I have to work on this. No, I'm not going to just sit down and watch television because I have to practice in this particular way. I have to get up early and make this happen. Every year in our school, we do this big school production, this big theater production, which takes tremendous energy from all the teachers, from many of the parents, from the children. And about halfway through every year, everybody who's involved, I've been involved in the costumes for several years, we look at each other and we say, why do we do this? This is insane. It's just so crazy getting 65 children from the age of 4 to 14, into this 2.5-hour production. It's just madness, and keeping the school going on at the same time. But then the performance happens. And no matter, how strung out or how impossible it seemed, my gosh, it's so thrilling to see what the children can accomplish, to see the power of the story, that by the end of the play, they're already planning the next one. Madness, complete madness. But you see, that's really what we're looking for. Because when we face and overcome, then we have that real power. Now, Jesus tells us, to all who receive him, to us gives he the power. That power to always remember, that power, and it's interesting, he gives us the power. And the power becomes ours. I don't know where it comes from. When you have a strong enough desire that it will overcome lesser desires, and you'll pull out of yourself, out of the infinite universe, this force that can just make it happen. Whether it's success in business, whether it's a triumphant performance, whether it's overcoming an illness, whether it's dying with courage, the power is always there if we will receive it. And then the masters add to this, and this is what our scripture reading is about. You have to stay in tune. It's such an interesting phrase, to stay in tune. Once you have a path, you have to stay on that path. Even if you don't know for certain what path yours is forever, then find a true path and follow it as if it were yours. Because you have to get into one groove, you have to get into one road, and then consistently, step by step, stay in that vibration. It sounds dogmatic, but it's actually the absolute opposite of that. If you want to learn to paint, you find a good teacher. If you want to learn to dance, you find a good teacher. If you want to learn to do anything well, you have to tune in to where the power is coming from. And somehow or another, make that one commitment. That's why Yogananda himself said, "Why do I do something so fundamental to my mission? Because Babaji told me to." And even just to intrigue us, it's like here he is, he's a master himself. But he's showing us how you tunnel through that wall. My guru told me to, and that's how I do it. That's the extraordinary teaching of the life of Swami Kriyananda, who in himself seems like such a powerful, self-generating motor of creative ideas and incredible capacity to just work and do and manifest. And he is always explaining to us, Master does it through me. I do it by attunement to my guru. I became a disciple in 1948, September 1948. The moment I met Yogananda, I asked to be his disciple. From that day to this, I have never wavered. And whatever he does, you know, it's always done in reference to Yogananda's teaching. Somebody asked me once about Indian chanting, the style of chanting that many of us really enjoy because we have an affinity for the Indian culture of what they call the bhajans, where you just repeat the name of God and you have all these long, you know, Durga Ma, Saraswati Ma, Lakshmi Ma, you know, just Jagadamba Ma, just one after the other, you know, Krishna, Krishna, Rama, Rama, Krishna, Krishna, just over and over. I love those chants, you know, but we don't really do very many of them. Why? Because Master didn't. Yogananda didn't. He was Indian. He could have. But he came to America and he wanted to bring something new. And even when he went to India, the only stories you hear about him chanting are, "Oh God, beautiful, door of my heart." And he doesn't, even there, he didn't do that style of chanting because he wanted something new. I mean, that's a whole discussion in itself. But the point is, that's where he wanted this to go. And you can say, "Well, I have my own free will and I'm going to do it my way." Yeah, you can. There's a wonderful story in Swami Kriyananda's book, The Path, about Sister Gyanamata, who was this elderly woman. She was older when she came, and she was older than Yogananda by a number of years. By that time, I think she was even in her 80s. And someone said to her, "Don't you want to have your own will? Why do you always run around just doing what he wants you to do?" And she said, in a kind of humble and somewhat tongue-in-cheek way, she said, "Well, I'm a little old to change now," is how she put it. And then she added, besides, she said, "I've never been happier." Because the reality of the power that the Master gives you is he gives you the power to be in tune with God. Just like a piano teacher teaches you to play the music of the great composers, he doesn't teach you to just sort of walk around and be like him. He teaches you how to do what he can do. But he can't teach you unless your consciousness is really focused there. I was I'm just going to put this thought out, and I understand, talking to all of you, that not all of you have made a strong commitment toward discipleship. But I do want you to understand these truths, and I would be doing you a disservice not to speak of it frankly and truly. A friend of mine who is a very serious devotee and has been meditating seriously for a long time was talking to me about having sort of gotten involved from this path a little bit into the Buddhist path, and he was talking about now, you know, thinking less like a devotee and more just about the power is within me, and when I meditate, you know, the power is in me. And I said something later in some context about, "Well, maybe you should pray about that." He said, "Well, I'm a little confused about praying now." because I'm thinking so much that this is my power that I don't know how to pray. I said, well, it's interesting, isn't it? That Paramahansa Yogananda, who certainly was fully conscious of the power that was in him, was always praying. And he gives us all these examples of prayer, whispers from eternity, which we read from every week. These are beautiful, poetic statements of how to pray, how to ask the divine force to help us, to come into us. And so if we're going to follow Yogananda's path, the example he set for us is one of a devotee praying. If you want to follow a path where that's not part of it, that's fine. But if you do half of this and half of that, you end up just, you don't receive anything. If you're trying to give someone something and they say, well, I'll take a little of that, maybe a little piece of this, but I don't like that part and I only want this. You know, it's very hard then to say, well, I'll invite you over to dinner, but you're only going to eat the beans. You know, how can I serve you? I really want to feed you. But if you're always going to be picking it apart and saying what you do and what you don't want, and from what level are we doing that? I mean, how much do we know? It's like you really ask yourself, oh, goody, I get to defend this little point of view and that little point of view. As one popular writer put it, he said, the reward for doing that is you get to keep all those delusions. Is that a prize? Really? You know, you look at the one who is burrowed through the wall and you understand what they're asking you to do. And then once you have decided that that is a path that's true, then you need to walk it with everything that you have. That's what it is to be in tune. To constantly remember, to constantly receive. Extraordinary promise. So-and-so became very, very advanced, who didn't even meditate much. She got there through attunement. She got there through simply locking her consciousness onto the consciousness of the master, riding that force, and he was able then to just give to her and give to her until she had the power to become a son of God. Isn't that amazing? All it takes, of course, is 100% of our will and concentration, but a very small price to pay, isn't it? To find a path and to follow it. And then the master's promise, the result is guaranteed. I mean, there's nothing else in life. I know the FDIC has guaranteed all our savings accounts, you know, and all these other things, and our insurance and all this stuff. Nothing. Nothing has that except the promise of the master. To all who received him, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God. Now that is a promise given by one who has the power to keep it. And all it is up to us is to receive it. God bless.